Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
There's not much good to say about frustration and anger, that is, until it drives the human spirit to do the right thing. Many of us are hardwired to react when we sense injustice. It is, after all, the intellectual reflection of our animal instinct to protect our own pack. Our hackles raise, our attention focuses, and then, well, we see what happens when a quiet genocide touches the soil. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wildside News. It's often easy to refer to people who try to do the right thing as humanists. And in today's spin, humanists and humanitarians aren't necessarily what makes the evening news. But it just seems appropriate that we take just a moment to think what a humanist is. And I suppose, I guess, a lot of that depends on what your definition of humanness is. Why don't you talk about how what it is that happened to you, too, and then where did it go from there?
Sure. Well, Aisha was, as you mentioned, the deputy director for the Center for Prevention of Genocide, and part of her job was to try to get the media, you know, everything from CNN and BBC on television to the New York Times and the Washington Post in print, and all the smaller media outlets, in both of those sort of mediums, as well as radio, interested in the story of, when she started hearing about it, about Darfur. And so she started contacting the media outlets and finding out, you know, what would it take to cover the story, why aren't you guys covering the story, that sort of thing. And the answers she kept getting were things like, you know, we don't have the resources to send somebody over there because all of our resources are, you know, being spent on in Iraq at the moment. Or, if one of our competitors isn't covering the story, why should we? This is a story that Americans wouldn't be interested in. You know, there are all these different, excuses as to why they weren't covering the story. So Aisha was extremely frustrated, and I had just finished a documentary film on Iraq called About Baghdad, and I just decided, you know, in our discussions, we just decided, hey, if nobody else is going to be willing to go and cover it, let's just go ourselves and go with cameras and see what we can do. And Aisha had already started developing contacts by virtue of her work, so we knew we could, at the very least, we knew we could get to the refugee camps in Chad and interview people there, and hopefully, we didn't know for sure, but we figured we could try to work out a way to cross over the border and get actually into Darfur. And our mission at first wasn't necessarily to create a film. What we were hoping to do at the very, our modest goal was simply to come back with footage that we could then give to other people, to media outlets to use, and if it meant sort of helping craft the story to report on for them, as a way to sort of motivate the media to going, you know, to sending people out there to cover the stuff, so be it. But we didn't necessarily have the idea for film, and that came a little bit later, both in terms of once we were on the ground and talking to people and realizing that we could do a full-blown film, and then secondly, seeing that the media in the fall of 2004 did start to cover some aspect of the story, although not in very much depth and certainly not without the sensitivity that we thought was needed and that was required, both in terms of explaining the situation and also in terms of having people speak for themselves. A lot of the media coverage in the fall of 2004 and winter 2005 ended up being interviews with Western analysts of African politics and of Sudan in particular, and very little space, both in print and on TV, was given to Darfurians themselves, and that may have been because of language issues. Not a lot of people there speak English, so it does require a translator, but still we felt that was unacceptable, and so we decided to go ahead and make this film and to really, you know, just put it out there and get people interested and get people, and people are getting interested in Darfur, but giving them the opportunity to actually hear from Darfurians And I could say, unfortunately, the marginalization of Darfurians and their voices has continued to some extent. I was just recently at the rally in Washington, D.C., held a couple of weeks ago, and I was surprised that of the speakers that they had on stage, there was not one from Darfur, although there are certainly a number of Darfurians here in the U.S. who are refugees who would have been happy to speak about what they experienced or what the news is that they're hearing from home. And instead on stage were all kinds of politicians, and George Clooney was there, and, you know, some others. But that's where our film really sits, and our mission really sat, was to put into consciousness the voices of Darfurians.
I think you make an extraordinarily good point in the sense, and it frustrates me too, that at these rallies it ends up being almost like a showcase for NGOs, all of whom are doing good, and celebrities and people of people who are concerned. But here's one of the things, and I'm actually working here in San Diego to help with the Sudanese refugees. And if I may say so, in the process of getting to know these people and being around them, this may sound like I have a unique form of prejudice, but I think they're an extremely intelligent, attractive, healthy, spirited, gracious, creative, well-spirited people. And unfortunately, somehow, when these stories develop, I think there's kind of a, I don't exactly know what it is that happens to the media and the American public and others, but it's almost like we write them off as if they are less than, what? Not, I don't want to say less than human, but not of the same value. And my experience, and this is what I want you to talk about too, is when you go and you're amongst the Sudanese and the Darfurians, these are a unique, uniquely beautiful, wonderful people. Why don't you talk about your experiences?
We were very lucky to have been able to share in the time that we had with the Darfurians that we met, who were gracious. I mean, the people who, as you mentioned earlier, who have literally had to flee for their lives and who have had the most severe kinds of trauma thrust upon them. Nonetheless, when we went to refugee camps, people, and these are people who are living, you know, on the margins of an environment that is inhospitable, to say the least, people would welcome us into their tents and immediately start to prepare from their rations that they had, tea or whatever little food they can scrape together for us, to treat us as guests the way they would treat people who were guests in their own homes, because culturally for them this is an important thing to do for anybody who is a guest to them. And so, you know, from little things like that to people who took the time out of, you know, in their destroyed villages inside Darfur, people who were displaced, who took the time to come away from the water well where they were collecting water to take back to their homes in the caves where they were hiding, to take the time away from doing that, to take us to their destroyed home, and all of the trauma that's involved in seeing that again and explaining what life was like for them. People were so gracious with their time and with their willingness to speak. I mean, and part of it, I think, does have to do with the fact that they did feel as if nobody was paying attention to them. And here we were, you know, coming with a camera or a couple of cameras, and, you know, clearly we were from far away, and we were willing to listen, and we were willing to sit for as long as it took for somebody to tell a story and to talk about their experience, and we were interested in their culture and in their history and their lives, not just simply, this was the other part I think that's important, is that in making this film, we weren't just interested in these people as refugees or as victims, we were interested in them for who they were, and for these people, although they've come to prominence, and this is not just true of Darfurians, but people in many parts of the world, they've come to prominence in the consciousness of Americans or of Westerners or of the international community by virtue of them experiencing violence or trauma or whatnot, but yet that's not their identity. Their identity is something different. Their status as refugees or their status as victims is an alien status, is an alien identity for them. And so I think that's something that we were very sensitive to, and that was expressed in the kinds of questions we asked and the kinds of stories we were trying to get. And I think people responded to that, and that's part of the reason why we were able to sharing these experiences. We were taken one night inside Darfur, inside the destroyed village. There was a wedding, which was just utterly amazing, that here is this, you know, unique celebration of life in the midst of all this destruction. And the bride and groom insisted that we be there to, not just to document it, we did bring our camera, but also to celebrate with them. That, you know, at some point they were like, okay, put down the camera, you must, you know, share with us, you must, you know, celebrate with us in our traditional way. And, you know, in that sense, we were just so incredibly fortunate to have these kinds of experiences and to be able, hopefully, to share that with, you know, a much, much wider audience.
The Sudan is a relatively inhospitable region for many, and yet the Sudanese have been able to have existed there for thousands of years. By the year 2000, they were still maintaining their culture in villages. They're an agrarian-based, relatively self-sufficient, holistic people with family structures and communities and exchanging life between different villages. Give us a sense of what you perceived as their life before this radical disaster began to happen.
Well, in Darfur, I think you had primarily two communities, one of which was agrarian-based and farming, and the other of which was cattle herding or camel herding, more nomadic community. And the two have historically coexisted. I mean, there have always been times where there have been, you know, disputes between different groups or different tribes or different families, and there have historically been ways for these groups to reconcile and to use traditional methods of reconciliation. Among the people that we met, you know, people lived in villages comprised of huts that were made from the natural elements that were around them, whether they were small trees or mud in some cases. But what was clear is that the desert in this part of the world, in this part of Sudan, is definitely expanding. And, you know, this is, I'm sure, attributable in part to global warming, and to certain other just sort of natural developments. But what's clear is that this expansion of the desert is certainly drying up water resources and limiting the amount of land that is arable, for both the farmers and for the herders. And so this is, the environmental aspect of this has certainly contributed to some of the tensions in the region overall. But this doesn't explain, of course, why there were 400,000 people who've been killed and 2 million made refugees and millions of others made homeless. Rather, this points to the larger issue, which is how are we globally treating the environment, and this is one of the sort of local ramifications of the overall processes of global warming, and should be, if in addition to all of the other reasons for concern about Darfur, it should also be a big warning light to those of us in the West and industrialized countries that the effects of how we are treating the environment have incredible impacts for people who are living in other parts of the world, including in this area of Darfur that you know, people have scratched a living from and found a way to survive and thrive for thousands of years, and are now facing, you know, in addition to violence, they're also facing a big challenge to their traditional livelihood.
Right, a good point. That's exactly right. That what we live our lives, we hear about global warming, but for people like that who, you've stated the case really very well, they've been able to maintain even in these inhospitable situations, and global warming is now tipping that and creating more difficulties. Let's now take a look a little bit at Sudan, because I've tried to paint a picture of the southern Sudanese, who are, in this case, the people being ravaged. And the attacks are well orchestrated and coming from northern Sudan. Help us understand what that's about.
Well, actually, in the case of Darfur, it's not quite the same as what you're pointing to is more like the historical conflict between north and south. In Darfur, which is more the western part of the country, what's happened is that the government, which is based in the north and which the elite of the country, the ruling elite, comes from just a couple of tribes and villages in the north of the country. What they've done is sought an alliance with a local militia, local tribal groups in that are in the Darfur region, and have sought to empower those groups versus other groups, and the other groups being people from the Zagawa, the Fur, the Masalid, the and some of the other smaller tribal groups. And they've used this militia in Darfur, which are called the Janjaweed, to attack and to basically, carry out raids against civilian villages. The government isn't sort of sitting back, though, and not taking a role. In fact, the government is taking a primary role, both in terms of arming the militias and giving them cover, but also in attacking. I mean, a lot of the initial attacks against villages and against civilian areas were actually conducted by what are called Antonov aircraft, which are huge bombing aircraft that are owned by the and used by the Sudanese military, and also by MiG fighter jets, which have been used, as well as attack helicopters. So there's been an aerial component to the assault against civilians and against villages in Darfur that is wholly the government, because no militia in Sudan has aerial weaponry or aerial power whatsoever. The militias that are empowered are attacking on horseback or on camelback and are, you know, conducting raids and committing atrocities against civilians. And in response to that, rebel groups have formed, both in terms of trying to defend the people of Darfur, but also to try to fight against the government in an attempt to remove the government from power, recognizing that this government has conducted this campaign and similar campaigns against the southern Sudanese, against people of the Nuba Mountains region in Sudan, people in the Kordofan region of Sudan. Increasingly now there are attacks against people in the eastern part of the country along the border with Eritrea, an area where people known as the Rashidiya and the Beja people live. And so what's increasingly recognizable today and for the last 20, 30 years is that this regime, which is based among a small elite in the north, is seeking to control the whole country, all of its resources, and marginalizing others, and employing various militia groups all over the country and to carry out attacks. In response, the Darfurian rebel groups, as well as other rebel groups throughout the country, are starting to recognize that each of their regional fights is part of a larger nationwide fight, and that includes the Southern Sudanese, the SPLA, the Southern Sudan People's Liberation Army, which signed the peace agreement, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2003, nonetheless is starting to recognize that that peace agreement is extremely fragile and most likely won't be implemented in the long term, and so they may need to pick up arms again as a means of removing this government from power and establishing a more representative government for all of Sudan.
Easier said than done. As our nation fights its version of its global war on terror, committing billions of dollars in resources, the terror of attack continues unabated amongst the people of the Sudan and Darfur. Is there hope for a resolution? We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.